sound of the voice.
Brother Sergeant!
Priad reached his side, fending off the brutal assaults from all quarters. Help Diognes!
I can't see him! Natus shouted. I can't see!
He's at your feet, brother!
Natus stooped down, dropping his empty weapon and groping blindly with his one good hand, finding the young Ithacan's collapsed form.
Does he live?
I can't see his life sign, Natus wailed.
He yelled Diogne's name out in despair, over and over. Priad wanted to turn to help him, but there was no break in the onslaught. As fast as Priad shot or smashed a greenskin warrior down, two more filled its place. Priad reeled from the concussive force of a cleaver that shattered against the left side of his helm, leaving a bare metal gash ruched in the metal from ear to snout. A massive orc was upon him, a chieftain by his bulk and tusks. His massive arms and torso were painted black and gold and wrapped in an armor of oily chains. He wielded a twin-headed war axe, whirling it like a quarterstaff. Priad ducked under one lethal swing, then dodged the return, blasting down a smaller greenskin chancer that tried to dart in and stab at him while he was occupied. Holding the thick haft of the double-headed weapon across his massive chest, the chieftain surged at Priad, aiming to run him down. Priad threw out his lightning claw and viced its grip around the center of the crosswise haft, splintering it. The chieftain staggered back, salvaging the broken halves of the war axe so that he now spun a battle cleaver in each paw. He raised them both overhead to split Priad like firewood. Priad jabbed the muzzle of his bolter up under the chieftain's sagging dewlap and blew out the back of his skull. As the huge orc fell, blood splashing out as he hit the ground, bolt rounds slugged into the greenskins at his heels. Dozens went down, maimed or slain by the crossing firepower. Chiron appeared, shooting his way into the heart of the melee to reach Priad, white flash flames sizzling from the barrel of his weapon. Roaring his approval, Priad emptied his own clip into the enemy waves in support of his apothecary's daring run. Chiron reached them, laying down further fire while Priad rearmed his weapon. His munition supply was perilously low.
Keep them off!
Chiron ordered without ceremony. As Priad renewed his blasting, ripping defense, Chiron clamped his bolter to his chest and looked at the two wounded men. Chiron tore open his narthecium and brought out instruments of brass and toothed steel. He had feared he would need his reductor to unceremoniously recover Diognes' precious progenoid glands, but the boy was miraculously alive. The pike had ruptured Diognes' secondary heart and both his natural lungs, as well as cracking his ribcage front and back. But the worst problem was blood loss. With the injuring weapon still in place, Diognes' struggling metabolism was failing to seal the wounds. Chiron drew his short sword, braced the pike, and lopped the head of it off with one sure stroke. Diognes groaned aloud. Without hesitation, Chiron yanked the headless shaft of the pike out through Diognes' back. Blood gushed free in a ghastly downpour, and the boy rolled limp. Chiron levered open Diognes' chestplate, used sterile clay from his narthecium to pack both entry and exit wounds, and then sprayed both with skin wrap to expedite sealing. He took out an inoculator and fired potent doses into the young Ithacan's bloodstream to stimulate coagulation and spike Diognes back to consciousness. Diognes began to tremble and jerk.
Quickly!
Priad yelled, keeping the enemy at bay as best he could. Chiron unlocked Diognes' helmet and pulled it off. Diognes sat up, coughing out a matted flow of dark red blood and bile. His face was sallow and pale. He blinked as he woke up to the maelstrom of noise and violence around him. Chiron helped him to his feet. Diognes seized his fallen bolter, reloaded it, and began to stutter shots out in support of Priad.
Keep strong, Priad told him.
He could see how weak and unsteady Diognes was. Chiron turned his attention to the miserably maimed Natus. He strapped bandage tape around Natus's broken skull and glued it tight with skin wrap. Then he locked Diognes' helmet over Natus's head. For the most part, this was an effort to brace Natus's skull and keep it held in one piece, but Chiron adjusted the headgear settings as he reconnected the suit systems. Natus raised his gloved hand to the side of his head.
I can't give you eyes, old friend,
Chiron yelled above the din of fighting,
but I can boost your hearing.
He'd notched the helmet's auditory systems up to maximum gain. Though it now plucked at his pain threshold, Natus could hear every excruciating detail of the war around him. Sounds assailed him. He could distinguish between the grating hum of Astarte's power armor and the jangling ring of greenskin mail. He could hear and feel howls and thundering footfalls as they washed in. Chiron pushed a reloaded bolter into Natus's hand. Immediately, Natus shot two charging orcs apart. Priad took Diognes' left hand and planted it on Natus's right shoulder.
"Lead him!" he yelled.
In a tight, blasting group, the quartet formed close and began to drive back into the press to fill the broken line. Ahead, they could see the blue light of Andromach's plasma weapon and hear the screams of its victims. They closed the rank. To their right, Andromach stood his ground, bellowing obscenities at the heathen masses, his armor covered in gouges and his standard tattered and frayed. To their left, Cylon fought with bolter and sword, his shield long gone, just a useless broken boss swinging around his left vambrace like an oversized bangle. He had taken a wound to his right hip, and his thigh was glistening with streaks of crimson blood.
"Damocles! Damocles of Ithaca!"
Cylon shouted as he saw them.
"Parthus!"
Natus gasped hoarsely.
"What?"
Priad asked.
"I hear Parthus,"
Natus answered. The order to break. It had been broadcasting for several minutes, but none of them had been able to make it out over the cacophony. Only Natus, with his hearing alert to every shred of noise.
"Break, Damocles! Break!"
Priad ordered. Iron snakes do not run, but this was not flight. This was part of the battle scheme as Petrock had planned it. Once word had come from Phobor at the head of the 25 squads, Petrock's relief company was supposed to pull back up the slopes to hold the head of the valley. The legions of the enemy swarmed after them as they worked their way backwards, channeling into the narrowing defiles of the canyon mouth like water rushing into a drain. The way was treacherous. Petrock's snakes were forced to move backwards, literally. They could not risk turning from the fight for even a moment. The terrain was steep and littered with rocks, and long-range fire from orc-heavy weapons mounted on vehicles back amid the orc horde raked across them, pulverizing boulders and heaving geysers of loose earth up into the air. A wind picked up, driving banks of smoke sideways across the valley, building great, choking rafts of cloud in the upper flues of the valley heights. The squads covered one another as they retreated. Laomon, under Brother Sergeant Lectas, reached the designated plateau first and knelt down, offering sustained cover fire to the others from the higher vantage. Lectas had lost two of his brave inductees that hellish morning. Pelias, with Brother Sergeant Gorant at their head, came up next. Gorant had lost his helmet to a warboss's chainsword, and part of his scalp hung away in a grotesque bloody flap. He whipped his seven remaining men up onto the plateau, and in those final moments of retreat, that seven became six as Brother Meglos was blown limb from limb by a screaming rocket. Laertes, the apothecary, leapt down the smouldering slope to the devastated body, his reductor in his fist and tears in his eyes. Nophon's squad, the right wing of the fan, backed up the slope, their munitions all but gone. Brother Bacchus fired single-handed, his other arm wrapped around the waist of Brother Sergeant Rhys, holding his beloved commander upright. Rhys had lost his right arm, and terrible wounds disfigured his chest and back. Still, he was yelling encouragement to his men, blood leaking from his helmet's filters. The swinekin gathered in vast numbers around the throat of the valley. Horns sounded, trumpeting a premature victory, the orcs believing they had put their attackers to flight. War machines churned forward, crushing over the piled corpses of fallen orcs, trundling onto the slope foot amongst the front runners of the greenskin horde. Rockets dazzled in the air, leaving streamers of smoke. Heavy shells pounded into the valley walls. An echo, like the rack of doom, rolled up and down the precious canyon. Priad brought Damocles onto the slope, firing as they came. Andromach, at last, had to dump his beloved plasma weapon, for it had become so overheated it was in danger of critical misfire. He blessed it as he set it down, smoking, on the steep incline, then drew his bolt pistol. 20 meters back, he put a bolt round into the abandoned power cell and blew the ancient weapon up in the faces of the advancing greenskins. A ball of blue light engulfed them, hurling painted bodies into the sky, some of them fused or scorched or denuded of flesh by the extreme heat.
"Where's Petrock?" Priad barked.
There was no sign of their master on the slopes, nor any sign at all of the fifth squad. Radetes. Priad searched the clamoring mass below for some clue.
"There!"
cried Xander. Petrock had been delayed in his retreat by a massive war boss, with whom the librarian had squared in mortal combat. Petrok had driven Belus deep into the war boss's sternum, but not before he had received two savage wounds to the chest and stomach. Redates, inductees all, and fired with the will to prove their valor on this, their first ever undertaking, had closed in a circle around the stricken librarian instead of falling back, as per the design.
"We can't leave them," Chiron bellowed.
"We can't leave Petrok," Priad agreed. "Xander, get Damocles to the summit. No arguments. I want two men."
Fate, and the simple disposition of the men, decided that the two would be Andromach and Akon. They were the two closest to Priad, though every brother, even Natus and Diognes, would have volunteered.
"Come on,"
Priad urged them. Chiron made to follow.
"Do as I ordered," Priad yelled at him. "Help Xander form the others tight."
"Priad,
do it! Help Xander!"
Chiron knew what this meant. It wasn't simply an order for now. It was an order forever. If Priad didn't return, Xander would be in command, and he would dearly need the apothecary. Chiron began to scramble back up the slope. Priad, Andromach, and Akon slaughtered their way back down the rocky rise, driving a path into the brute squadrons of the Painted Ones. They were no longer figures of grey, plastered as they were from head to foot with blood and gore. They were giants washed wet with the blood of their foe amongst the whirling phalanxes of black and red and sugar pink. Priad's trio broke in behind the circle of Redates, forging an exit by force of arms. Priad and Akon fired their bolt guns, Andromach supporting with shots from his heavy pistol and blows from his notched sword.
"Come on, this way!"
Priad shouted. Suthis saw him and snapped his squad around, pulling them back under the boom and whistle of the falling shells. Three of his inductees were gravely wounded, one badly. Suthis ran to his stricken brother and began to guide him clear, hacking with his short sword at the closing press of greenskins. Petrok stood his ground, defiant to the last, whirling Belus two-handed and squirting out forks of jagged light from his brow. Priad reached his side, firing the last of his shots. He clamped the empty bolter to his chest and drew his combat sword, striking out with it and his lightning claw together.
"Quite an hour, this,"
Petrok muttered to him as they fought side by side, holding the tide back long enough for Redates to filter away onto the clearer stretches of the slope.
"This must be what fate had in mind for us, master,"
Priad answered. Petrok snorted, felling an oak of a greenskin with a single bone-breaking blow.
"So, at last my friend Priad takes fate seriously," he retorted.
"I know this much," said Priad,
slogging and slicing, his limbs so fatigued they felt as if they were on fire.
"If this is fate's purpose, fate doesn't like us very much."
Chapter 16 Petrok, who seemed to find amusement in all things, including doom, was still laughing aloud as they reached the plateau. Suthis had brought Redates' squad onto the summit half a minute before them. Now the remnants of the five companies employed the gained advantage of height and cover, and teamed that to the narrowing of the valley, which forced the swinekin below them into a compressed formation as they poured up the slope. Such a narrow, defined profile made the orcs an easier target to contain, as long as munitions held out. The Painted Ones thundered up through the canyon mouth, and each rising wave was cut down as it came into range. A wide embankment of orc bodies began to form as the fratry guns found them. The embankment became a wall, a bulwark, as orcs clambered over it, only to be cut down to add to it.
"Swine guard!"
Suthis yelled in warning. Below, the greenskin mass was edging back and parting to allow the enemy elite a chance to try for the plateau. The swine guard were true monsters, each one of them a giant the size of a mature war boss. They wore polished mail linked with black gold and human bones, some of them carrying murder trees of black iron spikes on their shoulder harnesses. Clusters of human skulls, glowing white in the smoke-stained sunlight, rattled and clattered, pinned on the iron barbs of the murder trees as career trophies. The swine guard warriors were daubed in white body paint, banded with streaks of pink and red. Their throats were deeper, their roars more gut-shaking and bellicose than anything the fratry had yet heard. They eclipsed the warhorns with their howling. Natus shuddered and stepped back, fumbling to remove his helmet, one-handed. The swine guard began to assault the slope. Every one of them carried a chain blade of some description and a heavy bolter. Priad knew just by looking that some of those weapons would have been a true test for even him to lift, but in the ghastly oversized fists of the Swineguard, they seemed like toys. The boss leaders, larger even than the elite warriors they commanded, wore barbed helmets or bronze skullpots adorned with magnificent antlers 4 meters in span.
"I think you were right about fate," Petrock said.
He was no longer laughing. Behind the Swineguard came the formations of war machines, the fortress trucks and battle wagons of the Orc host. They chugged and clanged like steam engines, exhaling soot, driving saw-edged dozer blades into the mounds of the dead to plow them aside like snowdrifts. Chain cannon on the foremost wagons opened fire, and the iron snakes ducked as tracer rounds streamed over the plateau like luminous hail.
"Time for our last gift to them," Petrock announced.
The 5 squads had carried as great a quantity of explosives as they could bear with them over the pass the night before, just about every demolition charge they could muster from the landing ships. As they had advanced into the fight, they had seeded the explosives in their wake, inert, but primed. The charges had been prepared for sewing by Pindor, whose skill with such materials was without peer. The devices were on a lapse trigger that would be keyed by the detonation of marker charges. Priad beckoned Pindor to his side.
"Your privilege."
"Are you sure?"
Pindor asked.
"Quickly, brother."
Pindor raised his bolt gun to his chin and took aim. He knew as well as any of them that he was not the best marksman in the frattery. He targeted the lead marker charge. Pindor fired. The bolt crumped off the rock, a meter wide.
"For throne's sake," Xander growled.
"Oh, shut up. I'm just getting my eye in,"
Pindor grunted back. He aimed again and fired. The marker charge struck cleanly, ignited. The force of the blast showered stone chips into the air. The gravel went scattering down the depth of the slope into the faces of the advancing Swineguard. Harmlessly.
"Bloody hell,"
Xander exclaimed.
"We..."
Pindor turned to face Xander and held up one hand for quiet.
2, 1.
The slope came apart in a shockwave of fire and dirt. The magnitude of the backwash was so fierce that some of the iron snakes on the plateau were thrown over. Below them, Swineguard monsters were torn apart, or hurled into the air, or simply vaporized. A retching column of boiling fire and smoke rose up above the plateau in a mushroom cloud. In shuddering series, the lapse-triggered charges continued to fire, detonating right back down the slope and out onto the plain where they had been sown. Whole phalanxes of greenskins were obliterated in blooms of flame, and war wagons hurled over, disintegrating in showers of sparks and outflung scraps of metal and armor plating. With a noise like the Emperor's own thundering voice, part of the valley face came away in a colossal landslip and buried thousands of greenskins under a tide of churning rock that obeyed no master except the force of gravity. An inferno retched up the slope, consuming the few struggling orc survivors in the canyon. Torched orc munitions, some of them the payloads of fighting vehicles, exploded sympathetically, adding to the holocaust. As the booming echoed away and the veil of dust and ash began to clear, the 5 squads saw that an almost endless sea of raging greenskins still occupied the plains below, screaming and howling in outrage. But in the canyon slope and the foreland beyond, only devastation remained, a wild storm of fire and swirling smoke lifting embers into the air. Vehicles, smashed beyond all recognition, burned and collapsed, their chassis disintegrating. Thousands of scorched corpses littered the incline at the mouth of the valley.
"Move out," Petrock said. "Back up the valley. Now, while they're reeling."
Priad looked at him.
"What of the chapter master?"
"Phobor reports that the 25 squads have broken clear. They're heading for the landing sites," said Petrock.
"Fate loves us after all, Priad. It's time to join Sadon."
Chapter 17. By the evening of that day, the Iron Snakes had left the surface of Gennahedderach. Despite their losses, the extraction was a notable achievement. Several of the senior officers made it known that the action at Gennahedderach would stand proud amongst the attainments of the frattery. To most of the brothers, it felt like defeat. To most of the brothers, it felt like running away. It felt that way to Priad. He had never been so conflicted about an undertaking in his life. The warfare Damocles had weathered had been about the most intense he'd ever known, and the two battles they had fought had been unequivocal victories. Now the Fratry was simply consolidating its forces and shifting its tactical emphasis to a more viable footing. It was the pragmatic and sober thing to do. Any commander believing otherwise was committing unit suicide. But still, they had met a foe so vast in numbers they could not overmaster it in formal war. Their achievement had been simply staying alive, and they were leaving Ganahedorak to its fate. On the wounded world below them, the human cities and townships had been abandoned. The populations fled into mountain fastnesses and hinterland retreats. Woeful, lingering doom was all they could look forward to. The kings of the south and other potentates of Ganahedorak, as they became aware of the Fratry's forced withdrawal, sent raging, indignant messages after them, which became more and more venomous and, when no response was sent, faded into desperate, begging pleas. The Greenskins had also witnessed the extraction of the Iron Snakes. Though they had lost perhaps tens of thousands of warriors during the undertaking, no obvious reduction had been made in their sprawling hosts, and they gleefully celebrated the feat of turning the vaunted human champions to their heels. Across the ragged, pummeled continents, war horns and battle drums sounded out, raucous and frenetic. Huge voxcasters droned their triumphant trumpet blasts at the sky. Millions of swinekin voices ululated at the heavens, as if to shake the firmament down in pieces. The embarkation halls of the battle barges stank of blood. Not a brother amongst Sadon's 25 squads or Petrok's relief force had come back unmarked in some manner, and many were gravely wounded, as were many of the ancillary forces of armourers and attendants who had supplied Sadon's warband. Great quantities of armour and materiel had been damaged, some beyond the point of repair. Several vehicles in Sadon's complement had been abandoned or destroyed, and most of those recovered were crippled and broken. The apothecaries worked triage on the decks, stripping off armour to treat wounds, often ignoring their own injuries to work on the critical cases. Their efforts were bolstered by the physicians aboard the barges. There were the noises of movement and activity, and the moans of the wounded, but overall, a strained silence hung around the returning squads, the numbing ache of total fatigue and ground-down spirits. Sadon held council in the reclusium of his barge, summoning all the captains and the squad officers. The chaptermaster had refused all attempts by his hand-servants to wash him or bind his wounds. In his pitted, buckled armor, he sat on the central podium, caked in a drying residue of blood, both human and orc. Much of the human blood was his own. His face was a pale, drawn ghost inside the darkness of his cowl, and his breath came sharp and irregular through his exchanger tanks. His jigsaw cloak of polished wormhorn pieces had been ripped and torn, and loose fragments dangled from unraveling golden threads. His great lance, Tiborus, lay across his knees. As Priad entered the reclusium, bareheaded, with the other officers, he mourned the distressing appearance of the great master. Sadon seemed so dreadfully bowed and hunched. The blade tip of Tiborus was nicked and buckled, and deep cuts had been gashed into its mighty shaft. Priad stared, for it was so seldom any brother apart from the highest ordinates got to see the chapter master in person. As he took his place in the ring of warriors, he found himself captivated by Sadon's left hand. Sadon had removed his gigantic gauntlet and allowed it to fall onto the deck at his feet. His bare hand, so very large but so very human, was the first proof Priad had ever seen that Sadon was sheathed in flesh and blood like the rest of them. Priad hated himself for noticing that Sadon's left hand trembled slightly, as if palsied. How Ganahedorak had reduced them. It had forced even the chapter master, the legend that bound the Fratry together, to expose his mortality. Slaves had lit myrtle, orb, and camphor in the burners around the reclusium, and perfumed smoke drifted through the cold air. Starlight twinkled in through the stained glass of the towering arches. The ring of warriors around the podium filled in and became complete. In their broken, gouged armor, the officers stood at attention. Some, like Priad, carried their buckled, scored helms under their arms. Some dripped blood upon the deck. The odour of sweat and filth and body matter and the coppery stink of blood quite overwhelmed the sweet smell of the incense. Every surviving officer was present. From Petrock's force, even Rhys had come, leaning weakly against Suthis, his upper body wrapped with dressings bound tight and red wet around the shreds of his missing limb. Others were just as mangled. Crito of Aegis had lost his left hand and the flesh of the left side of his face. He carried half of his helm, a cloven half, in his right gauntlet. Mykos of Lacedaemon, victor of Pensus and Tribulation Rex, nursed a terrible stomach wound. Icleus of Thebes, great hero of the Berod fray, had suffered an amputation below the right knee and leaned with effort on a sea lance. Priad felt ashamed of his minor scratches and cuts, even though he was aware of the bruised tissue swelling and throbbing across his face from his left ear to his cheek. Sadon made a gesture, and Cycleon, the master chaplain, conducted the rite of the sharing of water. Tall and mournful in his power armor, Cycleon's silver skull mask seemed entirely in keeping with the mood. At a gesture from him, boy slaves brought forth the usipus, the copper death urns, and set them on the deck before Sadon. They were empty as yet, but soon they would confine the ashes of the fallen for the voyage home to Ithaca. There were 61 of them, 10 for Partha's squad alone. Priad swallowed hard.
"Good counsel," said Sadon after a long silence, "is the backbone of any fratry. We are victorious, yet defeated. Valiant, yet disgraced. Alive, yet broken. Like beloved Ithaca, this undertaking has a bright face and a constant darkness. I salute every one of you for your efforts and your courage. I order you to impart that salute to every brother in your commands. Any shame of failure is mine, and mine alone."
"Not so, master," Phobor began. The veteran captain looked like a vagabond, so torn and frayed was his once proud plate. Sadon raised his bare left hand to hush Phobor.
"Mine, and mine alone. Brothers, since the foundation of our fratry, there have been 18 chapter masters, an illustrious lineage that it has been my duty and my honor to follow. Under them, and under me, the chapter has won sterling victories and many laurels, and has suffered its defeats and routs like any good company of warriors. Just as we relish the triumphs of Falling Star, Presarius, Ambold 11, Cornac, or Far Hallow, and etch those deeds upon our fortress walls, so we regret such disasters as Berrien, Outward Calenc, or Forbrium. But never before have we seen a day like this. Never before have we taken victory and defeat in equal measure. Never before have we relinquished an undertaking and left behind us a people crying out for our aid." He rumbled into silence, murmuring, "Never before," one last time. No one spoke. Sadon stroked his bare hand along the notched haft of his beloved lance. "This drives against our oath, our ancient compact. This disgraces our bold claim of undertaking. For that error I blame myself. Only in the time of Sadon has such a calamity befallen our order."
The chapter master lifted his lance and threw it onto the deck with such vigor that the weapon rolled away from him and came to rest at the feet of the ringed warriors.
"I must make amends, my brothers. I must find a way to turn this infamy into glory, for the sake of our spirit and our name. But I am at a loss to know how. We are the greatest warriors of our age. We can meet and squarely best every monster that rises against us in formal war, but we cannot match an endless foe. And the greenskins are without limit or end. Though we heap their corpses to the heavens and beyond, still they will come."
Sadon lifted his head to look at his men, so that the light fell in under his heavy cowl and caught the line of his chin and cheek. There were beads of blood upon the white flesh.
"So I look to you now, my warriors and my brothers, for counsel and answers."
No one spoke for a moment.
"We have to think," said Petrock finally.
All eyes turned towards him. He was standing in the ring, his back hunched with pain. The wounds to his chest and stomach, delivered by the war boss, urgently needed attention.
"So I have said, librarian," Sadon answered. "Perhaps time to reflect."
"No, master," Petrok cut in. "I mean we have to think our way to victory. We have reached a place where every scrap of our martial prowess is worthless. We have to use our brains instead."
Several of the officers, including Phobor, sniggered in disgust.
"Might is all we have," announced Mermaid of Anchises. "Might is what we do so well."
"This is no longer a matter for warrior brethren," said Suthis. "A fleet must be gathered. This is a duty for warships in formation."
"Suthis is right. Where infantry has failed," said Sardis of Lystra, "we should take our vengeance by fleet action."
"Burn the orcs and the worlds they tread upon," cried Phanthus.
"Should we burn Gunnahederach?" asked Petrok.
"If that's what it takes to rid the reef stars and fulfill our undertaking," Sardis replied curtly.
"Burn all those people?" Petrok sighed.
"They're dead anyway," Phobor muttered.
"Let the orcs suffer the chapter whole," cried Medes of Scipio, drawing assent from his brothers. 25 squads? 30? Let them face 100 and flee to the dirt that spawned them."
"Aye,"
Icleus called out.
"Turn the fratry loose and burn them to hell."
"Would you magnify this misery, Brother Icleus?" Petrok asked quietly.
30 squads, and we take home 61 urns. Would there be anyone left alive to carry the urns home to Ithaca if we turned all 1,000 of us upon the greenskins?"
"You repudiate our skills," snapped Medes.
"If such fatality is where your thinking gets you, Petrok," Phobor tutted, "I'll stick by my muscles."
"You do that," Petrok snarled back, earning hisses from the ring of warriors. "The orcs are strong and hardy, resilient to injury and countless. Are we not swift and clever? Are we not beings of culture and ingenuity? Must we descend to their level and play them at a brute game we cannot win?"
"Give me the chapter at arms, and I'll show you how we can win," Medes exclaimed.
"If I gave you the chapter at arms, dear brother," Petrok replied, "you would show me 1,000 dead heroes."
Medes, bullish and heavy-set, the master of celebrated Scipio, the finest warrior in the fratry and captain of the finest squad, took a step towards Petrok. The officers around him dragged him back by his arms.
"Not here,"
Cyclion warned, pointing the haft of his thunder hammer at the pair, the way a schoolmaster would point with his cane at unruly pupils.
"Bite your tongues and hold your rage, or I will drive you from this holy place."
"My apologies, Master Chaplain,"
Medes said, cooling.
"As Brother Medes says," Petrok smiled. "His apologies."
Medes surged forward, stung by the insult, and only the strong hands of Phanthus and Phobor restrained him.
"That's enough,"
Sadon growled.
"Bad enough we reel from the orcs. I'll not have us fighting ourselves. Petrok, my kind brother, retract your slur to Brother Medes."
"I will not, master,"
Petrok said. White fury gripped the still restrained Medes. The other officers glared in dismay at Petrok's insubordination. Sadon rose.
"The devil is in you, boy,"
he said, stepping towards Petrok.
"Then let's hear what the devil has to say for himself,"
a low, grating voice echoed from the shadows. Sadon looked round and sighed. He sat down again.
"You're awake then, Master Autolycus?"
"I'm always awake,"
the voice replied.
"Noise you idiots make. It's hard to slumber."
Hydraulic pistons hissed in the gloom, and the warrior ring parted respectfully to admit the new figure. He towered over them, clomping forward on his thick bionic legs, his huge grey chassis casement draped with ancient, flaking pennants. The venerable dreadnought Autolycus took his place in the ring of warriors.
"I say, let's hear Petrok,"
Autolycus said, his voice gusting dry and toneless from the synthesizers in his bodywork. A veteran captain in his age, Autolycus's battle-mutilated remains had been cased, with honor, in the dreadnought mechanism for perpetuity. An ultimate weapon, like all dreadnoughts, Autolycus was kept in hibernation for most of the year, woken only for triumphs, or ceremonies, or crises.
"Yes,"
said Medes, shrugging off the hands restraining him.
"Like Master Autolycus,
I would be intrigued to hear the complexities of Petrok's scheme.
Autolycus pivoted his huge metal bulk around so that his ocular sensors regarded Petrok.
Let's go, librarian. Make it good.
Petrok nodded to the huge, sentient war machine.
I have been plagued with dreams this last month. Pivotal dreams, in which the manner of our deliverance, excuse me, the deliverance of the reef stars, has been foretold.
When a librarian dreams, Autolycus rumbled, it pays to listen. If I'd listened to Nektor, I wouldn't be 4 tons of scrap metal.
Some of the officers laughed.
The dreams of a librarian count, Meadows offered. But all I've heard from Petrok is rubbish about using our brains.
Rubbish is all I have, Petrok assured the company. Disjointed, dislocated nonsense about a set of jaws, and about Priad.
Who's Priad?
Meadows asked, pretending not to recognize the name.
Brother Sergeant of the notable Damocles, Autolycus rasped. Your arrogance does you no favors, Meadows.
Priad felt a sudden fluff of pride. Autolycus knew him, knew his name, and station.
Oh, that Priad, Meadows said. Speak up, Brother Priad. Tell us how you feature in these dreams.
Priad coughed. Well, there was a meadow, and also a black dog.
He paused. His voice sounded pathetic and thin.
Now we're getting somewhere, Phobor mocked.
Petrog held up his hand to gently silence Priad.
My dear brother and friend Priad doesn't understand this. I don't understand this. But I declare to the band of warriors here, if you let me go from here with Priad to Baal Solok, we will secure a victory for you. For the reef stars.
How?
Asked Ichlius.
I don't know, replied Petrok. Not yet.
You'll be doing something there, will you? Taunted Meadows. Using your minds?
Many of the warriors in the ring laughed.
Just a while back, Priad said quietly, on Ithaca, out on the Cydides Isthmus, my apothecary, Chiron, ventured to me that the time of brawl and force of arms might be waning.
The petitioners we were training lacked all martial vigor, lacked the guts, as Chiron put it. But still, and I admit this with a happy heart, they outsmarted us and won the drill. They bested Damocles' squad.
Not hard.
Don't make me come over there and hurt you, brother, Priad said.
The petitioners bested Damocles' squad, and I'm proud to confess it. They outplayed us with their minds. Weaker than my brothers, they outthought us. We were playing a simple martial game, a physical exercise. The cheese run, you remember that, don't you, Brother Sergeant Bylon?
Bylon, Sergeant of Vei, nodded.
The petitioners couldn't match us, muscle for muscle, so they changed the rules, and won. Chiron said to me that maybe brains represented the future. The rise of brains and the fall of brawn. I said I was sorry, as brawn was all I had.
This raised a sympathetic laugh from most of the officers.
I don't know why I'm telling you this. Gods, I don't even know why I'm speaking aloud in the presence of our master and lord Autolycus. But I know battle, and I know how the most curious of patterns can form out of the randomness of war. I believe Petrok is right, and I believe I am somehow part of that pattern. Me, and the meadow, and the black dog. I don't know how, but I'd like to go to Baal Solok and find out. I'd like to use my mind for once. I envy Brother Meadows for not needing one.
You bastard, Priad,
Meadows spat.
Oh, now you remember my name,
Priad smiled.
You little...
Shut up, Meadows,
said Sadon, rising to his feet again.
Petrok, undertake this with Damocles. The bullworm is yours to command. If you come back empty-handed, then don't come back at all. The rest of you, see to your wounds and your men. We'll counsel war again at the edge of the system. I will consider full deployment in...
He paused.
How long to Baal Solok come back, librarian?
40 days,
replied Petrok.
45,
contradicted Autolycus.
50 days, then. After that, I raise a fleet to full deployment of the Chapter House. Death or glory!
We will not fail the fratry in this, Petrok said.
I'll make sure of that,
Autolycus grumbled. The dreadnought clanked around to face Petrok squarely.
It's been a long time since I last did anything useful. I'll be coming with you.
Chapter 18. Drive engines flaring, the fast cruiser Bullworm ploughed on through the airless winter of the stars. Every man of Damocles had accompanied Priad, even Natus and Diognes, weak from their wounds. Diognes was a shadow of his former self. Once a virile youth, as robust and energized as Xander, he now walked with aching steps, his breathing chopped and curtailed, his skin sickly. It would take many months of recuperation, as well as augmetic and bionic surgery, to restore him to battle prime, and even then that recovery was not guaranteed. There was a chance that Diognes' career as a Fratri warrior was done, and he would spend the remainder of his days amongst the ancillary staff of Charybdis.
"Let me come,"
he had said to Priad, when the brother sergeant offered him the chance to return to the Fortress Moon with the main force.
"This may be the last undertaking I make with plate upon my back."
Natus was in better spirits. There was something eternally vital about Natus, a wellspring of vigor that had seen him through many wounds in the past, including the loss of his original arm. No augmetic refit had been made yet, but a skullcap of grey iron had been cased around his head, surgically screwed to the bones, to preserve the integrity of his healing skull. Before scar tissue could cover the ruptured nerves of his ruined eyes, Chiron began a preliminary round of reconstructive surgery during the first few days of the voyage, installing the neural plugs and socket brackets for augmetic implants. The eyes themselves would be connected on Natus's return to Charybdis once the initial work had healed favorably. For the rest of the voyage, Natus wore a blindfold of bandages around his eye sockets. But Chiron had run relay leads from the nerve meshes inside the sockets and connected them to a simple ocular scanner, providing Natus with basic monochrome vision and depth perception. Natus wore the scanner on his forehead, attached to his skullcap by a magnetic coupler. He looked for all the world like a cyclops of old myth. With Petrock withdrawn to his quarters for medication and further probing of the spirit domain for answers, Priad took charge of preparing Damocles. There was a body of armourers and fitters aboard the fast cruiser, and they set to work on the squad's war gear, so much of it mangled or ruined. The brothers themselves put the strength of their arms into the repairs, under the supervision of the master armourers. Weapons were stripped down entirely, and every part of them cleaned and blessed. Blades were re-edged, or in some cases, replaced. The damaged functions of power armour were repaired. Andromach had been brought an old but functioning flamer from the ship's magazine stores to replace his lost plasma weapon. Priad hoped that on their return to the Fortress Moon, Andromach might be granted a custodianship of another heirloom plasma gun, and thus restore Damocles' heavy bite. Andromach spent many days of the voyage sitting apart from the others in the corner of the martial deck. Like all of Damocles, he wore a simple chiton or himation, for the plate cases were undergoing their refurbishment. Andromach was working on the squad's precious standard, the emblem he always carried between his shoulder blades. It had come through the two battles on Ganahedorak, the worse for wear. Andromach was patiently repairing it, patching it back together with pieces of chiton and storm cloaks, using tough fishing twine, silver thread, and long sailcloth needles. Great Autolycus roamed the hold decks and empty hallways of the fast cruiser, brooding and unsettled. It was as though, once roused from his mechanical dormancy, he could not abide being still. Often, as the brothers of Damocles took their exercise runs around the ship's corridors, they would encounter his trudging, clunking form. On the eighth day of the voyage, when Priad was on the martial deck observing the industry of the armorsmiths, Autolycus appeared and called to him. Priad withdrew with the dreadnought to a far corner of the deck.
"Tell me about your undertaking to Baal Solok," Autolycus said.
Priad recounted the venture, as best as his memory would serve. He spoke of the ruined land, the downed primal war party, the cruelty inflicted upon the people of Baal Solok. He spoke, too, of Primary Clerk Antoni and the purging he had dealt out. Autolycus listened, then questioned Priad repeatedly, closing in on certain points of the story and urging Priad to recall more and more of the specific detail. Priad found that the careful interrogation prompted him to remember tiny fragments that he was surprised he could dredge up after 12 years. He remembered aspects of the countryside, his munition tally, even the name of the black dog that had run through his dreams.
"Princeps," he said,
The dog was called Princeps. Priad wondered why Autolycus was so concerned with the details, presuming the ancient warrior intended to build the most complete tactical picture possible in his mind. But before he could ask, they were interrupted. Cylon appeared, with an agitated look on his slender face.
Chiron needs you, he said.
A gaggle of boy slaves and attendants were waiting around the entrance to Petrok's quarters, and they scurried away as Cylon brought Priad and the lumbering war machine to the place. Within the lamp-lit chamber, Chiron was kneeling beside a cot on which Petrok lay, so pale and still, Priad feared he had been carried off to the other world.
The attendants found him,
Chiron said quietly.
Our brother librarian has neglected treatment for the injuries he took on Ganahedorak, and that neglect has caught up with him.
Chiron lifted the blanket he had placed across Petrok's torso and revealed the ghastly wounds the greenskin war boss had handed out. They were deep, much deeper and more significant than Petrok had pretended. Despite the superhuman resilience of his body, septic corruption had set in. Petrok was in a feverish stupor.
Infection, perhaps even poison, raked into the wounds by the filthy orc,
Chiron said.
Is he dying? Asked Priad.
Yes, replied the apothecary. Yet he may live. At this time his life hangs in the balance. If his body and myself can fight the infection, he will recover. But if they can't...
Chiron glanced at Priad.
His survival is in fate's hands.
Priad thought about that, and didn't like the sound of it very much.
This means you have command,
Priad said to Autolycus. Autolycus's voice rumbled out of his hull casing.
By dint of age and experience, yes. But I'm no squad commander. Not anymore. You should have seniority here, Priad. Consider me your ally, but don't expect me to lead.
Priad stared at the huge machine, at the graven images of war and the purity seals that decorated the front of his hull. There was no arguing with a thing like that. In the subsequent days, Petrok's condition grew steadily worse. He did not wake or become lucid, but was given to fits of raving and convulsion, accompanied by a dripping fever. Chiron began to fear that there was more at work than simple wound infection. Some evil influence seemed to have Petrok in its grip, and would not let him go. Rites were performed of cleansing and purification, to banish evil spirits and demons from the echoing halls of the Bullworm, to no avail. On the 17th day of the voyage, with Baal Solok within reach, and Petrok relapsed into a profound coma, Priad had a dream. It was as strange to him as the last, for dreams visited his pragmatic mind so seldom. Stranger, in fact, for from the start of it, he knew he was dreaming. He was standing in the sunlit meadow, under a wide blue sky, surrounded by golden corn. He could feel the breeze on his skin, though he was clad in his full power armor. He felt weightless, as if he could take off and, with one bound, touch the harvest moon. Looking down, he saw his armor was as new, polished like a mirror. He took off his war helm and realized with some mystification that it had the laurels of a captain marked around the crown.
"Why am I dreaming?" he asked.
The cornstooks hissed. Familiar hills rose white and clear above the far edge of the meadow. He looked around for the black dog, and it appeared, as if on cue, trotting through the corn, snapping playfully at spiraling cornflies. It came up to him, tongue lolling from a grinning snout, and cocked its head.
Princeps,
Priad said, remembering the name from his conversation with Autolycus. The dog barked twice, then turned away and took off into the corn, running from him on a zigzag path, slowly disappearing from view in the nodding gold. Three times it stopped and looked back at him, barking again on the final occasion, until he responded and began to follow it. The black dog led him up through the meadow, through the hissing corn.
"Slow down,"
he called out once or twice, as its lead on him increased. It was a pleasant enough dream, he thought, engaged by the rarity and reality of it, and especially by his lucid participation. He knew it was a special dream, and wondered if it was like the true dreams Petrok and his kind experienced. By the time he had followed the dog to the far end of the meadow, Clouds had run into the sky, and the sun went in, hidden behind them. The light became grey, the corn white rather than gold. It grew colder. The black dog, still black, barked again. Shadows were forming in the edges of the meadow, beneath the stands of olive trees and under the mountain woods. He realized each footstep he took made a crunching sound. He looked down again and saw that he was walking on a crust of ice. The corn stalks were frozen and brittle. The dog's breath made little clouds in the frosty air. Priad realized he was stepping out onto the great glacier Craratia, that giant of Ithaca's southern pole. He looked behind him and saw the overcast meadows of the Pythoan cantons, and ahead, the blue ice and air fronts of the polar glacier. Dream logic, he supposed, laughing aloud and half enjoying the impossible segue between landscapes, between worlds. He stepped out onto the ice. The black dog had gone. Mean winds shrilled along the glacial crags, and surface snow, wind carried, smoked off the cusps of the drifts. There was a storm coming. He walked onwards, anticipating something, but only sure of the fact he should anticipate. He wondered if he could wake up if he willed himself, but dared not try. This was a true dream, and he was loath to break its spell. The great snow bear waited on the ice shelf ahead of him. He could not say where it had come from, for it had not been there a moment before. Instinctively, he reached for a weapon, but there was nothing in the loops of his harness except a golden figurine of Parthus. Priad looked at it in surprise for a second, and the figure became ice and melted in his hand. The snow bear came closer. Priad realized it wasn't a snow bear at all. It was a man, swathed in white fur pelts. It was Petrok. "Fit for war?" Petrok asked. The great librarian smiled, but his face was as white as a death mask, and his bright eyes sunken in dark circles like bruises. "If war awaits," Priad replied. "Why are you in my dream?" he asked. "I'm not," said Petrok. He was limping, and his arms were pulled tight around his body, as if for warmth. "You're in mine."
"I don't understand," said Briard. "How can I be in your dream?"
"Because I sent for you. It was the only way to make contact."
"You sent for me?"
"I sent a psychopomp."
"A what?"
Petrok sighed, as if the explanations were a struggle.
"I sent a guide to bring you to this other place. It probably took the shape of that black dog of yours."
Priad nodded. Then he frowned.
"I still don't understand."
"And I don't have time to explain,"
Petrok said. He glanced at the skies behind him, the cold black vault of the polar night.
"There's a storm coming. It's been chasing me for days. You can't be here when it comes."
"Come with me, then," Priad said. "There's a sunlit meadow just a few steps behind me."
Petrok shook his head.
"Not for me, there isn't. That's your dream, the one I summoned you from. This is mine, and I'm stuck here. Do you know where I am?"
"Craratia," said Priad.
"No, my oh-so-literal friend. I am on my cot, in my quarters aboard the Bullworm, dying and insensible. I fashioned this polar dream so you would recognize it as a meeting place particular to us."
"I still don't understand this," Priad said.
"Then just listen to me."
"But this could all be my dream, and you are a part of it, and I'd just be listening to myself, wouldn't I?"
Priad asked.
"I can't convince you otherwise. But that's no reason not to listen anyway, is it? I need to tell you things. My consultations with the darker places have brought me answers that I must convey, and cannot in the waking world.
Because of the wounds you suffered.
Petrok chuckled and opened his furs away from his naked chest. The mortal gashes were there, but he bled not human blood, but orc ichor.
This is not the greenskin's doing. Those injuries just weakened me, made me susceptible.
To what?
To our enemies. Listen to me, brother. Listen. Hear the things I would speak to you in life, if I could only return there, sensible and awake. This effort I've gone to is the only way I can make myself heard. I'm listening.
The pitch of the wind rose, and crystal ice danced in swirls around them, carried up off the blue glass face of the glacier.
The greenskins cannot be defeated in formal war. Not even if our chapter was multiplied a thousandfold. This bloody truth the spirits have revealed to me. But there is a way to drive them from the reef stars. They are at war with each other, tribe upon tribe, mob on mob, host on host. And this war has been engineered.
Engineered?
Priad echoed.
By what means? By whom?
Who is so cruel and malicious they would use the carnage of others for their own ends? The primals have done this. Unable to muster enough force to take the reef stars out from under our protection themselves, they have fanned the flames of hatred in the greenskins. They have triggered the orcs' fury, setting the swinekin loose to do their dirty work for them and achieve what they could not.
How does anyone, even a primal fiend, force an orc to do anything?
Priad asked, almost amused at the notion.
By stealing that which is precious to them. An ancestral trophy, a relic of great consequence. The jawbones of an ancient and revered war boss, a champion leader, sacred to their species.
The jawbone,
Priad said, beginning to shape the truth in his mind.
The primals you purged on Baal Solok, 12 years past, had accomplished the theft, but their damaged craft was forced to set down on that world. Their intention was to carry the relic into human space and leave enough providence behind that the orcs would blame mankind for the crime.
But it was destroyed,
Priad said.
That only aided them in the long run. Their traces were covered.
No wonder that bastard laughed before I killed him,
Priad said, remembering at last the one detail that had previously escaped him. Petrok shrugged and took another anxious look back at the encroaching storm. The horizon at his heels had lost definition as the distant blizzards fogged the air. Above their heads, the bright stars were fading from view.
For over a decade,
Petrok said, his words slower and more halting, as if pain was racking his innards.
The warp witches and carrion lords of the primals have been casting suggestions into the minds of the greenskin tribes, goading them in dreams and visions, showing them lies about where their prize has been taken to. It has caused mob wars, faction fighting. Whole worlds in the swine territories have burned out in the heat of hate-inspired violence. Now that frenzy has spilled into our protectorate. Needled by the mystic urgings of the primals, the orcs are pursuing their relic into the reef stars, slaughtering each other for the honor of recovering it.
What do we do?
We give it back to them.
Priad roared out a bark of incredulous laughter.
But is his lost? Destroyed?
Not all of it.
But
any true scrap will contain enough genetic trace,
Petrok cried, having to raise his voice now against the moaning of the wind.
Enough to prove its truth to the greenskins. Ask Chiron. Such work is not beyond our fleshsmiths.
The glacier shuddered. Pelting ice whipped across them in a brutal flurry, driving from the darkening south. They were forced to shield their eyes against the deluge.
"Time's up!"
Petrok yelled.
"The storm's found me again! You must go!"
"But
get out of here, friend!
Get back to the meadow and the waking world.
Petrok turned, huddled in his furs,